Hello, this is Meet the Writers and I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today ought to be on your literary radar. She probably is. She's been making huge waves in the world of fiction. In 2015, then-President Barack Obama named her work Fates and Furies his book of the year. She's been on the shortlist for every big US prize going and was named by Granta as one of the best young American writers of her generation. She's a New York Times best-selling author and was number one on Amazon. She has a new collection of short stories out. It's called Florida, which is where she lives. But I'm delighted that she's here in London and with me today. Lauren Groff, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, you may live in Florida, but actually you're from Cooperstown in New York. Where is that?
Oh, in the middle of nowhere. Absolutely. It's a tiny little village of about 1,800 people in a vast swath of farmland. And it's on a 9-mile lake. It's very beautiful. The only reason anyone would ever know of it is because it's where the Baseball Hall of Fame is, which is not something that I think that you here care about at all.
No, sorry.
But I don't care about it either.
What was it like growing up there if you weren't particularly a fan of baseball?
Oh, no, it was terrible. So we lived right on the lake in the middle of town, about a block and a half away from the Baseball Hall of Fame. So we saw all of the tourists, every single one of them. And at times they camped on our yard. But it was actually a perfect place to grow up because my parents are very busy people, very in their own world. And they just let my siblings and I just do whatever we wanted to do. And so what I wanted to do was read all the time. And I did a lot of sports. And it was benign neglect in a really beautiful way. Mm-hmm. And it made my sister into a professional triathlete. It made my brother into a doctor. And it made me into a writer.
Well, let's talk about these overachieving children, because your sister is Sarah Chu. She's a 2-time Olympic triathlete. As you say, your brother's a doctor. Were your parents quite proactive, or was that benign neglect a way of kind of letting you find your own way?
They're very supportive. So no matter what we said that we were passionate about, they let us do it as fully as we possibly could. I think a lot of times the family culture is created by the oldest child. My brother is one of the swaggering men of the world. So he walks into our room and he takes up all the space and he takes up all the oxygen. And so my sister and I, it took us a very long time to understand that we actually couldn't speak in a public space and that actually we didn't want to be overheard by our brother all the time. And I think our life decisions are somewhat predicated on the fact that we were just pushing against this overbearing male in our lives.
And yet, in terms of kind of global success, you and your sister would appear to have surpassed him.
I think that we just chose the things that we were passionate about. And I think both of us, my sister and I, would have been happy if we didn't necessarily have the success that we've had if we were allowed to just do our thing. Mm. I mean, I think she stopped doing Olympic distance triathlon and she started doing Ironman. She loves it. She's almost 40, right? She's still just going out there and exercising all day long, every day, and killing it. In our family culture, nothing's ever quite good enough. So we really have to just work on what's happening right now.
So it must have been quite hard moving away from what really seems to be a close family off to Wisconsin to study fiction writing. Did you always know that that's what you were going to do?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, it took me a long time to get to Wisconsin, and I lived everywhere. I lived in France. I lived in England. I lived in Philadelphia. I lived in Kentucky, in Canada. We were really peripatetic for a long time. And I started writing very seriously in college. Something happened to me and I just realized that I wanted writing to be the very center of my life and everything else was going to come around it. And at that time, I was actually a poet and I was told by the universe that I'm not a poet. I wrote every day and I wrote 3 novels after college. And then I was also a bartender. Just decided I need to just take all the time I can get and go get my master's for 2 years and sit at the feet of Laurie Moore, who was my goddess at the time, and just learn everything I could. So that's why when I was in my mid-20s, I went and got my MFA.
And then your first book, your first published book, was about discovering family secrets and going through the family tree. You wrote about also the different perspective on the same relationship. How much of this was inspired, do you think, from your own relationship dynamics?
Interestingly, that's the one that has the outline of autobiography without necessarily having much autobiographical or even very personal in it. It's the most invented. All of my other books seem to stray from the realm of autobiography, but they're much closer and much more personal to my own life experience.
Mm-hmm. So, well, let's talk about Fates and Furies, of course. This is the book that really catapulted you onto the world stage. President Obama, as we know, named it his book of the year in 2015. To know that he'd even read your book must have been extraordinary.
Well, he was a sitting president, right? What sitting president reads, let alone reads fiction, let alone reads fiction by women? Okay, so here's the best part of it. It slayed me. It was one of those things that you didn't even know to hope for. Then it happened, and suddenly men started reading me, which was great. I love women. Women have been traditionally my readers. Barack Obama made it all right for men to read me. Eventually, at a certain point, about a month after he had named it his book of the year, I get this huge envelope in the mail. And the return address just said, the White House. And I opened it. And he wrote me a handwritten note that talked about why he loved the book. And I just sat there going, what human being has this much kindness and courtesy and ability to reach out to other people? Nobody. I mean, nobody. And it just makes the current situation right now so sends it into really harsh relief, to be honest. I mean, to have someone who cares about the life of the mind and the life of the intellect and the cultural aspects of America and the and reads fiction, which I find very necessary, but I think a lot of politicians definitely wouldn't. And to go to this black hole of narcissism and idiocy is just, it's just devastating, right? There's no writer I know who was able to take it with any kind of calm or anything less than mental distress.
But I mean, it may well inspire great writing to come.
Well, I mean, I'd prefer to have the vulnerable among us not suffer. But if great writing comes out of it, oh, that's all right. But it'd be better if children weren't wrenched from their mother's arms at the border, right? It'd be great if people didn't die because they didn't have health insurance. I mean, I am upper middle class, right? I have health insurance through my husband. I had an emergency C-section that cost me $30,000 out of my pocket, right? And that's a book. I had to write a book in order to pay off delivering my child. It's just the state of the country is just a disaster. Mm-hmm. It's just a slow-moving juggernaut crashing into the ocean. It's just so bad.
Well, of course, you live in Florida now, and you live in a very blue part of Florida.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, so Gainesville is in the swamps. It's not even on the ocean, which means that it's even less elegant than other parts of Florida. But it is a university town, and the university does overwhelm the town. So we have a lot of great thinkers, and we have, I think all of our taxi drivers have multiple PhDs. So it's a highly educated place. And in some ways, it's a very protected place for people who are progressive. Then you go about 2 miles outside of the town, and you start to see Trump signs. You see Confederate flags, people openly being proud of white nationalism. You know, it's this weird schizophrenic existence.
How did you end up there?
My husband is from there. His family has been there for 4 generations. They had a bookstore, so they, you know, they're all very great and progressive. So he took over a family business. And the thing about family businesses is if you take one over, you can never get out. You're stuck forever because of family dynamics and the fact that you don't want to disappoint anyone.
All your stories in your new collection, it's called Florida, are obviously about Florida. But you've talked about how you tried to resist writing about the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I came to Florida with a great deal of baggage and stereotypes that I thought that Florida was, right? Because the only thing I really knew about it before I lived there was Disney World, which is a very different realm of existence. And my parents-in-law live in a gated community. It's very segregated. My town is actually, even though it's progressive, it's still the 4th most segregated city in America. And my parents-in-law do not know any people of color, period. It's not because they're not progressive. They are. People don't live in the same neighborhoods, and the schools are very segregated. So I moved down there feeling disdain for the state. Florida is the punchline of every other state's jokes. I really had a lot of contempt for it. And so I did resist writing about it because I didn't necessarily want to write about something I didn't like. I wanted to write about a place that I loved, like Cooperstown.
And in fact, you have written and about Cooperstown.
Yes, yeah. But that said, I actually think that the writing from a place of alienation is really rich, and it's an ambivalence is really profoundly interesting. By ambivalence, I don't mean, you know, wishy-washiness. I mean really powerful emotions in opposite directions. So I love Florida. I hate Florida at the same time. It's all mixed up together. It's really inextricable.
Is writing a place that you were still getting used to, as you were when you were writing this book, a way of taming a new reality?
Oh, interesting. Probably. I shy away from thinking about writing as anything other than art, but in certain senses, it could be cathartic. And I think it's possible that I was working through my ideas about this place that I found myself in, trapped in, to be honest. I can't get out unless I divorce my husband, and that's not happening. So I'm trapped there. And so I guess possibly it was like the monkey drawing the bars of the cage, right? I was just trying to understand the scope and shape of the world in which I found myself.
Because it's quite angry. It certainly starts off very angry. This woman kind of walking out her anger. And I wonder, again, motherhood, a big, big theme in here, how autobiographical this is.
Well, I'd say it's not autobiographical. The reason writers choose to call their books whatever they call them for reasons, and it's fiction because I do make up a great deal. It's as truthful as I can make it, but it's also invented at the same time. So there are aspects of it that I play with. With my first book, for instance, there was a hysterical pregnancy, and I went on book tour vastly pregnant. I actually came to England, and I was 35 weeks pregnant. I should not have been allowed on the plane, but I was. And in the course of the book tour, people would stand up and say, "So, are you sure you're pregnant?" Right? So I realized that the biographical fallacy, you know, the conflation of writer with her characters is inevitable, particularly if you're a woman. Particularly at the time, I was a young woman. So I thought, I'm not going to school people out of this assumption, so maybe I can play with it. And since then, I've been playing with seeding in things to tempt the reader's assumption of biography and then to spin it out again and sort of play around with that closeness and that feeling of closeness to what people perceive to be the truth.
Mm. If one wanted to categorize it, then could you call it autofiction?
Well, you could call a few of the stories autofiction-esque, yeah. I have mixed feelings. Everything that I feel is mixed. But I have mixed feelings about autofiction, right? Because people talk as though it's a new thing, but it's as old as writing. In some ways, one could argue that St. Augustine was writing autofiction. And it's very much a mid-20th century mode that people are now writing through. And some people are doing it absolutely brilliantly. I'm thinking of Rachel Cusk, who's just, she's changed the form, right? Ben Lerner is really good at it. Teju Cole's one book is good, right? It's very good. But at the same time, I'm wary of writing within a certain genre or mode because I'm afraid of the bars of the cage coming up again.
And that's a cage that, putting it in its landscape form, giving it its place in the world. Another phrase or another word that we're hearing a lot around literature is psychogeography.
Oh, right, because of the Situationists and Gedebord. Well, I was deeply invested in Gedebord for a long time. And in fact, there's a short story here, the last story called Ypres, and it's based on something that did not happen. I did actually take my children to France in order to research the early life of Guy de Maupassant because I'd been working on this project for over 10 years at that point. And it had started as a translation project. I was translating some of his more feminist short stories into English. And then I realized all the feminist stories died after he'd been writing only for about 2 years as his tertiary syphilis took place and changed his brain and made him a rabid misogynist. And then I thought, oh, this is interesting. So I wrote a whole novel, a historical fiction novel on Guy de Maupassant, and that was bad. And so I threw it out. And then a few years later, I wrote a book in which Guy de Maupassant was the central figure, but he wasn't actually seen. It was just in the voices of people like Flaubert and the Goncourt And there was a lot of Gita Board in there, a lot of Situationists. And I was thinking through this idea of Guy de Maupassant without him in the text. And I finished it in December 2016, right after the imposition of Voldemort into the White House. I looked at this book and it was so ingrown. It was like a toenail, right? It was only talking about literature and it wasn't engaging in a political way, in any interesting way. And I just thought, this is not the time or the place for this. The time and the place for this was 10 years ago. And so I threw that out and I wrote the novella that ends this book instead about how to raise good men. I don't know how to, but I want to. Yeah.
Does writing have to be political?
I think when I was a baby writer, I read a billion interviews of older, usually white men writers who said, you know, writing cannot be political. We actually have to be above the fray. But the truth is that's a position of profound privilege because everything that you do in terms of communication is political. Choosing not to speak is political. So if this is the case, then a literary writer who pretends that she is above politics is making the choice, a very bad political choice, to be honest. So I do think that your work is inherently political. Whether or not you want to make it into a sledgehammer or into a scalpel is up to you. Mm. And I'd prefer not to make it into the sledgehammer. I did a great deal of research on my second novel into polemical, sort of utopian text narratives. Bellamy, William Morris, I mean, the whole list of utopias. That kind of writing is not effective to me. I actually think it's anti-effective. But I do think that a lot of poets work in a very elliptical political way that more profoundly acts upon a writer. And that's the kind of political writing that I would like to do. Maybe not direct, maybe not polemical, but I definitely think that we need to be addressing what's happening today, now, here.
You talk about raising good men, and motherhood is obviously a huge theme in Florida. I understand you and your husband formed a contract before you embarked on parenthood. So tell me about that.
The thing that I noticed before I had my children is that a lot of relationships perish because of built-up resentment, particularly in the forms of expectations about who's going to do what, right? If it's not clearly delineated or set out, a lot of things fall on the mother, the woman, because of societal expectations. And that kills me. So way back then, I made him actually sign a contract. First of all, I gave away my freedom. I live in Florida. So basically anything that I put on the contract, he would have been fine with. But from the beginning, we've had really clear differentiation in roles. And in fact, I would say that he would also agree that he's the 60% parent. He's the one who's always around while I flitter off to London. And he's the one who wakes up with the children, who feeds them breakfast, who gets them into the clothes and gets them to school so that I don't have to see a human face or hear any human voices in the morning when I work. And so, you know, it seems very harsh and very unromantic, but it's much better. Our relationship's much better because we both know what to expect. And there's not a lot of built-up resentment. And if there is, we just pull out the contract again and I point and say, you agreed to this. And it's a living document. It changes as we change and as we grow.
Tell me about maternal feeling or indeed anti-maternal feeling.
It's complex, obviously. My children are the best people in my life. But I don't define myself primarily as a mother. And I work very hard to try to keep that out of a lot of the conversations that I have because it has nothing really to do with my work except for the fact that once in a while there are small children in the work. I have a good deal of anger about the way that women are pinched into shape by our society. And I feel always oppositional. I'm constantly irritated by mommy culture, for instance, right? And by this assumption that women are better because we're self-sacrificing. And I refuse to sacrifice myself. But at the same time, find profound joy in my children. And watching them grow has been a source of beauty and creative insight. And they're not there for me. I'm there for them. But that's a totally separate space from my work. Mm. I'm just claiming the things that male writers take for granted.
And it's clear that you're also trying to, or that you're very engaged with making a better world for your children and others to grow into. I mean, climate change, you write a lot about wild weather too, don't
yes,
you?
Yeah. Well, Florida's so vulnerable to climate change and we see its effects on a daily basis. I don't know if you're aware, but we have a red tide. The bacteria are doing a massive fish kill and manatee kill and all dolphins. Everything's dying on the Gulf side of Florida right now. And it's because the waters of the Gulf are many degrees higher than they generally are, which, and the nitrogen runoff has gone into the ocean. It's just one aspect of which Florida is just being pounded by climate change. I mean, Miami is going to be underwater in 10 years. And if that happens, our aquifer gets salinated. People cannot live in Florida. It's tremendously scary because I'm aware of what's happening. Sometimes I get upset about the stories that we choose to tell that are solipsistic or narcissistic or talking only about humanity as though we're not also animals, right? As though we're not also part of the larger world and the larger net. And my political will goes toward the ideas of climate change, I think, particularly in this book, but also in the way that we treat other people and how we treat vulnerable people. And there are going to be far more vulnerable people in the world of climate change than we can even imagine right now.
This book, Florida, took, I think, 9 years to come
together? Yeah, at least. Yeah.
So are you working on the next?
Oh, I'm always working on something. A lot of times I write a draft of a novel and then throw it out because it's not good enough. And in between finishing Fates and Furies and now, I've thrown out probably 2 full novels. But, you know, I don't believe anything is lost. I don't fetishize the sentence. What I really love are the ideas and the people and the way that there's an interaction with the world. And so I know that those good elements, those living elements are going to come back into my work at some point. But the form that I chose was just dead on arrival.
That's a really depressing way to end this.
I know, I'm sorry. So nothing is ever lost. And it's all about what's happening at the moment, right? It's all about the writing that's happening now. And I am writing something that I'm really excited about. But we'll see if it works out. It doesn't matter if it doesn't, but we'll see.
Lauren Groff, thank you so much for coming on to talk to me.
It was such a pleasure.
Florida is out now. It's published by Heinemann. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Anna Savetska and Christy Evans. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.